Hello everyone, welcome to No Draft. Today we invite a wonderful guest, that is Edveth. He's now in Minnesota with Jasper.
So Edveth, you can brief introduction of yourself to our audience.
Sure, thank you, Jasper. As Jasper mentioned, I got the pleasure of meeting Jasper during a week-long project competition trip in Pittsburgh where we were roommates. So I'm a Minnesota resident. I've been here for the past 13 or so years. Before that, I lived in North Carolina for a few years, and I was actually originally born in India.
So today we are going to talk about the book called
Sapien: History of Humankind by Yuval Noah Harari.
Okay, you can just make a brief introduction to people who have never read the book. How well you using like a 500 words to describe?
Yeah, so I think Harari does is he takes this idea of history, which many people often see as a recorded series of facts and events that historians piece together from whatever contextual clues they can obtain. And he puts that within a framework of the natural sciences and applies this thinking framework to it. And it's a very exciting book. There are, you know, periods of sensational writing within it. But there's also a very interesting lens that he applies to human history. He divides it into four major parts: the cognitive revolution, the agricultural revolution, the unification of humankind, and the scientific revolution. So you have these four really interesting thematic principles to consider human history in. And I think within each one, you have really interesting intersections between psychology and history, and almost a blend between humans in an individualistic perspective and as a whole, as a culture. So that's a really interesting way to think about it.
Yeah. So I have talked with Vivi about all the ideas this morning. And yeah, I think the most impressive point of view when we read the book is the cognitive revolution.
Yeah.
And I want to elaborate a little bit with this part.
Yeah.
This is not only like a historical book, it's more like a philosophy, or I would believe the author is a thinker. Looking in the history, but in another point of view.
Yeah.
Like he discussed a lot of things about fictional objects, like money, the nation, or company, or a brand. Even the Facebook is just a fictional object. Comparing to the physical objects. For me, it's like a mind-blowing, because not many people think this kind of things in this way. Something is very fictional, but we could suffer from something fictional. Money is fictional. There's no real value in money itself. It's just a paper. But day to the Stone Age, or no, not the Stone Age, the Hunting Age, when people are doing commercial, the original money is the grand. You can eat like rice. So it has some value for that. But in our like 21st century, money is useless itself. But we believe in the common story. We believe in a common value system. Money is has some value in it. So it's based on trust. I trust the community. So I use these kind of things as a commercial thing. The suffering is very interesting for me, because suffer could be original from pain. It's very hot, it's very cold, so I suffer from that. But for the human itself, nowadays, we suffer a lot from something fictional. We suffer from money, we suffer from the layoff. Oh, I got layoff from the fictional company. It's a real company now, but it's actually fictional. It's the company like Facebook is only in our mindset. You agree there's a company, I agree there's a company, so everyone agree. Then there's something called a Facebook, and that has a logo. How do you think about that?
This idea of imagined reality, as he mentions, is just so interesting to think about, and all of the implications in terms of how people's worldview and their perspectives on their lives might change if they put things into the perspective of all of these constructs being rooted in a shared trust and a shared belief of this imaginary existence, as opposed to something that is concretely, directly required for survival.
When I read that chapter, I thought that if everything is about narrative, the way we think and the way we speak, the follow-up question in my mind is, how can we as a group to build up a new story, have a new concept or a new narrative way to shift mindset together or to change the path of history? In the last chapter, the book also mentioned that the history is not the linear path. It's just uncertainty and opportunity emerge, and then we become what we are today. I'm thinking that how the collective story become, and can we as individual to shift or change the story of history or the future?
I think it's a very hard question for me. Do you have any idea?
I have some idea, but I would like to listen to your thoughts first.
Sure. So yeah, and I'm sure you've heard the phrase, right? Like, the victor of a conflict writes history. So it is interesting to think about the history that we read and consume and know, the way we think about history, as composed both of these narratives that can be incorporated into any series of events or objective facts, but also you have an almost evidence-based side to history. Things like primary evidences, historical artifacts, ruins, and all of these together tell a story. However, you have people who are piecing together a narrative of history based on these primary artifacts. So you have another opportunity to introduce a narrative. And I think as humans, we like narratives. We like stories. We like things that are easy to connect and understand and relate to, things that fit into schemas of understanding. And so that's another thing to consider in the way history is understood. And I think history can help shape the future. So in this indirect way, these ideas of people having a certain way of thinking and then bringing that into history affects the future as well.
I didn't want to try to directly answer the question, but what I think, because I also listened to a podcast from Yuval Harari, and he's once mentioned that human, this species collectively, we are very good at chasing the power, not individual level, but in a group level, in a community level. We are good at chasing a higher power, and we are government most of the environment, the biology environment, or occupy order, most continent and the earth. Well, listen to your feedback on the history. Let me remind me, we are trying to increase our power and our control to everything. But the upside, what I want to really dig into deeper, is that our happiness, our life, even we have like 10 times of power and our daily life is 10 times or even 100 times of convenient than the Stone Age. Because of our biology, our brain still didn't change very much in our genetic perspective. Maybe we are happier than Stone Age because we don't suffer from the pain, didn't suffer from the cold.
Yep.
But it's not 10 times the happier. Our power is 10 times. Our daily life is 100 times of convenience than late, like 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago. But in an individual level, because of our brain, it's just fixed. Our feeling, every feeling, your love, achievement is all sensation. It's just the endocrine system. You feel happy by some serotonin, dopamine, something like that. It didn't change very much. Maybe you can say, oh, I'm happier 1.2 times than the previous thousands of years ago.
Yep.
But basically, it didn't change much. So I think it's very interesting to comparing the chasing over power, but in an individual level, you are still maintained like just a primate animal.
So I think what you're saying is convenience and happiness don't scale identically. And that's interesting to think about because, yeah, you know, we see all these positive messages, posts online, quotes and things that tell you to take a moment, reflect, and to really be thankful for all the good things that there are in your life, all of the things that help make your life great. And then yet, you still have a lot of dissatisfaction, a lot of unhappiness that arises. I think, you know, part of what you're saying comes from just the evolving landscape of what life looks like, you know. So maybe in the era that you were referring to initially, happiness might have been a meal and a place away from the cold or a reduction of the pain in one's environment. But now, you know, there are those similar underpinnings that take place in a different kind of context. So for example, someone suffering from food insecurity, you might say they still have a better environment around them, more convenient environment. But at the end, you know, it's still hunger and a fear of hunger that can really cause a lot of distress for someone. So, you know, I think even though we can have all of these tools and all of these artifacts to improve our lives, those basic needs still persist, and as long as those needs persist, there will be a concomitant almost stress or distress about those.
From both of your viewpoints, I wonder that if the imagination or the narrative story power is privileged for a certain level of people. Because if we are below the survival line, we are suffer from the hunger. We don't have much time to think about the future, to build up new story or to influence others because we have to take care of self to survive first.
Well, for me, I feel like it's really a privilege to thinking about some of the color first world question, like you are worried about your investment, you are worried about your career path, and you are not worried about like water supply, because like a developing country is always care about the sanitation or water supply. But you don't need to worry about that. You only worry about, oh, which car should I buy? Should I buy a Tesla or should I buy a different jewelry, something like that?
Yep.
So it's different level of suffer from people to people because of their social class. They have a privilege to doing these kind of things.
You know, that's again interesting to think about. Like, are those benchmarks for happiness self-constructed? Or if they are, you know, socially constructed, is that again rooted in the imagined reality? These things will bring us happiness? And is there a way that people might be able to find happiness without those imagined realities or benchmarks? And it's easy to say, maybe harder to implement in practice. But one thing that I've noticed in a lot of happy people is their ability to find contentment and peace in a lot of the small things in everyday life. Things like making, you know, a warm cup of tea and sharing that with a friend. Things like going to the movies with a friend. You know, being able to go and play tennis with a friend for an hour each week. A lot of things like that are ways people can sometimes break out of a cycle of distress or pursuit towards something and instead find happiness in the present.
I would say totally agree with that. Just the little happiness in your daily life. It's not much different from you are like Warren Buffett. You have the most money in the world, but your happiness in your brain, your sensation will be just totally like 99% the same, because it's just the neurotransmitter working in your mind and how you feel. It's actually the same. When I read the Homo Deus, the next book of Yuval, he's explaining the future. It's interesting to discuss. This somehow answers Vivi's question, how will be the next generation, how we shift to... He's mentioned the evolution. We are from Stone Age to now, but highly possible we will evolve in the next kind of species with only a little bit of a change. Then we can make a total difference from human erectors to human sapiens. It's just a very minor DNA change. or genetic material change, then we jump a lot. For example, we can have a transplant with your body using the artificial intelligence technology or biomedical technology. And you can live longer, you can live even younger, enhance a lot of ability. At that point, medical advancement is automatic to increase the longevity of your human lifespan. For the rich people, they want to live forever. But for the poor people, they don't have the money to support them to this kind of technologies. So they will make a very unfair scenario. What's your thought about that?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting to think about in terms of the costs of healthcare and the outcomes that it provides in different settings globally, different settings, even within a country like the United States, what different types of care can do for different types of people. And an example of this, one that I've read a little bit about, is global neuroscience and global neurosurgery. There's a statistic of a huge chunk of the global neurosurgical techniques that are being developed really end up coming back to the United States and serving people within the United States. A much larger portion than the proportion of the United States' population in the global population. And that's one example. And another one is when you think about the resources associated with care, there's a lot of work being done. For example, if there's resources that are being used in dialysis for a kidney disease patient, there's work being done to understand how can we apply those resources such that the person doesn't get to the point where they need the medical treatment in the first place. Is there some way those resources can be used towards prevention? I was having a conversation with a couple of nephrologists or kidney doctors, and what they told me was that the greatest advancement in nephrology in the past decade, maybe two decades, was prevention. A focus on preventing the disease. You know, I sort of went off on a little tangent here, but I think it just coming back to your point, there are different ways we can use different resources for each setting to achieve maybe an optimal outcome.
I totally agree that the medical improvement should focus on prevention rather than to cure people after they got disease. Because that will be more fair. If everyone can prevent from the disease at the beginning, we don't have to spend lots of time.
And what's really unfortunate about disease and illness is that it can affect people from all backgrounds, you know, regardless of wealth. And sometimes even having more resources, having more wealth can't prevent the progression of a disease. And so the work that people are doing to treat and care for and develop treatments against these diseases is really important. There's a quote my friend likes to say. He says, "Good health is a crown that the healthy wear, but only the sick can see." So it's something that's sometimes taken for granted, but really something that would be great if everyone was able to have. So working towards that is really important.
Why you would like to study medicine?
Biochemistry, yeah.
Biochemistry. Is that linked with your personal goal or something like that?
I really enjoyed my science classes in high school and really had this interest in understanding more at an increasingly granular level the way life and the world around us kind of works. And it's a really very elegant system. Human physiology and the natural world. These phenomena are just so in harmony. They achieve really amazing functions and having developed from a very simple predecessor, from a very chaotic environment, to have a pressure that directs the sort of development of human function in a certain way. And learning more about it really has been fulfilling because in biochemistry, for example, one of the big themes is understanding how energy is utilized by the human body, how it's stored, how it's consumed, really basic things for life, and connects a lot with physiology and medicine. And so from there, you know, my goal is to combine this passion for service, how to improve people's lives with this interest in science, and that sort of aligns with the medical career.
I really like your point. You focus on your passion about the science rather than in, for example, for Asian people, they will say, because being a doctor will help me earn a lot of money.
But also, I'm curious about your background. Is there your parents also want you to be a doctor?
My parents are very open. You know, they never pressured me into doing a particular career. So they kind of gave me the freedom to explore and choose.
So I think one of the chapters which is very interesting is about the marriage of science and capitalism. It is emphasized that the current science is tied very closely to capitalism, especially for research or development. The purpose for the medical advance is mainly serve the power, serve for the national. Because a lot of new technology is after the World War II, like penicillin, is making the next war, the next weapon, stronger. So it's basically serve for the ideology. Do you think science currently is in a neutral way, or you agree with the description of the book, because the marriage of the science and the capitalism is tied very closely?
It's a balance. Capitalism, it definitely is a motivator to drive innovation and research, and it's a reason why industry is a big contributor in America to a lot of technological advancement, and you know why we see a record-breaking pace of innovation in things like artificial intelligence and the way it can be applied to various sectors, how it can improve operations, how it can contribute to improved healthcare. But on the other hand, we also have institutions that are rooted in scientific discovery simply for the sake of scientific discovery, things like universities, organizations like that, and many people who are driven by curiosity to discover, to innovate, because it's thrilling and it has the potential, more importantly, to create an improvement in people's lives, improve the world, create positive change. And so as long as there are people who have that kind of aspiration, there will be a home for them to.
But the argument in this book is that working on science, or you are working on research, you need the money support, the financial support. So the financial support is mainly like the government,
yep,
or the big tech, big companies that support specific something like, oh, I won't live forever. So you do stem cell discovery. That makes sense. Yep. But if we want to just for the pure of the beauty of the science, it is very unlikely to perform this kind of experiment because there's no funding for that.
Right. And I think, you know, as I sort of mentioned, most importantly, at least for me, is the ability to use science to improve people's lives. And when that's the outcome of the science and the research that's being done, there's a strong rationale for funding it. You know, people are working on it, but it's going to benefit a large number of people, many people around the world, and so that is a really big motivation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further question you want to discuss? I know you have a list of notes. You can like choose one or two points you want to share with us within the book.
Sure. So one thing we can think about is the number of different human species that existed. Do you guys have any thoughts on that aspect of the book? I know he mentions that the last dwarf species of humans died out 12,000 years ago, and it's interesting to, I did a little bit of reading about this before I'd come to this book, but that number has in recent years maybe been pushed back further to 60,000 years ago, as opposed to 12,000 years ago. But there's some archaeological evidence for these dwarf species humans. We aren't, you know, sure yet whether it's its own species or maybe an insular origin from a starting group of people. But that's just one example of the many, many different. There was also the discussion with the Neanderthals. So there's a quote from the book that says, they were too familiar to ignore, but too different to tolerate. Early on, you see a unity among the Homo sapiens, put them into conflict with the Neanderthals. Do you have any thoughts about that?
You mean the conflict between Homo sapien and Neanderthal?
Yeah.
If I remember correct, physically, Neanderthal has more advantage comparing to the Homo sapiens. What's the major difference between those two? If I remember correct, it's still the collective cooperation. We can, because we believe some mythology or believe in specific systems, so we can leverage all of the population's strengths to eradicate the Neanderthal. That's what I got from the book. How to make something powerful is like still the story. Genetically, we believe something story and we are very emotional species. Even the story is totally fictional, but we could believe that if they speak in a very touching way, believe and then have a collective cooperation, made the Homo sapiens currently the strongest species all over the world. Any other thoughts you have?
I think that the nature choose which species can stay
longer. Yeah, nature selection, yeah.
Yes, whether it's physical strength or the way we collaborate with each other, that would impact how the species can stay shorter or longer.
Any other thoughts or other points you want to share?
I'm not familiar with the science of animal, but probably we can check which species stay longer than human beings. What's their working models? How they collaborate with each other. We can learn from other species to find some similar or special way that they can survive.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's correct, but the mushroom, they will communicate with their, I don't know how to say it, the hands. They have the sense to
spores.
Yeah, they will feel other mushrooms' feelings, and when place got fired, they will pass the message through their roots, their hands, to communicate with other mushrooms, and they would turn off some function of body and to protect themselves. So I think the communication, no matter in what kind of ways, is really important to make the species can stay longer.
Well, yeah, I think you bring out the communication way. Like, communication is not only enough, because most of the species, they can make communication, but the most advantage is that we can communication in a specific way.
Mm.
Because a lot of sensation for me is you cannot describe in language. You just feel that. Nobody knows what's love, but you can feel love. But there's not a good term or a terminology way to precisely describe a specific way. But with the advance of science, maybe we can turn out, okay, we can clearly define which kind of sensation is based on like a neurotransmitter and how the interaction between different of biochemistry or interactions. Maybe it could be elaborate someday in the future.
Yeah. Another thing that maybe we could talk about is that in the book, he mentions how as a whole, the body of knowledge that we have access to and possess now is greater than it ever has been. But individually, people are much more specialized. So, you know, you see this in industry, you see this in research trends, people being experts at one very specific thing, and that's how they contribute to a larger system. Ancestors, they were more knowledgeable and more skillful overall, and they had a more application of knowledge, very wide-ranging application of knowledge as it pertained to survival, than people do now. Think that's interesting?
When you say that, I think it's because of the agricultural revolution from my point of view. Because of the agricultural revolution, so you can have a larger population in your village, then you can specialize in something specifically. But in the Stone Age, if we are only hunter, we need to deal in all the stuffs by ourselves. In a perspective from like natural selection, it's very vulnerable. Because you are only specialized in something. If the job disappears, you lose your job. You don't have other ability to survive.
Compared with our ancestors, the modern people invent a lot of tools and technology to serve ourselves. So we don't have to, for example, tell the directions we would go when we are driving, because Google Map would tell us where to go. So our sense of direction may be worse than our ancestors. I do think that some abilities or skill sets, we are not better than our ancestors. It's inevitable if we want to live in the modern environment. We will definitely keep invent tools and new technology to support us to live much more easier.
So advice, when you write a note, what's your which way would you prefer? You want to specialize in something, or you want to be very diverse to kids?
You know, that's hard to pick from. And I think in the pursuit of new knowledge, that specialization is key, really, to be able to build upon something. But there are so many interesting things to learn in the world in so many different topics, from learning about other people, learning about the arts, learning about science, that it's hard not to want to almost become a specialist in everything to that level. So that's a hard, difficult question. What about you? Would you rather be a specialist or a generalist?
Well, for my personality, I would prefer a generalist. Like, I know everything, but just everything a little.
I want to go deeper in some area that I'm really interested in. However, if I don't leverage other subjects or to learn interdisciplinary to think issue I'm focused on, I will face bottleneck really soon. So probably I will still focus on one track that I'm really interested in. However, still leverage other people and domain knowledge from totally different area.
Okay, so I can make a final conclusion. So I want to emphasize when we discuss the fictional and physical objects, I really like this part of talking about the suffering. A lot of people, the pursuit of happiness is avoid the suffering. We could suffer a lot of things, but when we realize most of our suffering, it's actually the story itself, the story of money, the story of capitalism, the story of career path. We really need to be clear to think about, is that a real thing or is a fictional thing? Should I suffer from this kind of company? Because it's also fictional. So it still suffers, but we should reduce the level of suffer at some point. Like marriage, I married someone. But if we divorce, the marriage itself doesn't have anything feeling. Only people, human itself, has, oh, I feel so sad. So that's interesting, like thinking about that. The marriage is between a trust. It's something fictional. So at the physical level, you should not suffer from these kind of things. You should look in what's the truth, what's something only in your mind. Maybe you only suffer by yourself, by your mindset. When you can turn this some kind of mindset in a different level, you very clearly understand, I don't need to suffer from money because money is just a fictional story. If I live in the mountain, I don't need money at all. So I don't need to suffer for that. So I think this kind of mindset change would be very important when we dealing with our mental health. It could be a very helpful toolbox for us.
I really enjoy the book because there are many concepts that's really novel for most of the people. It's a good resource to discuss the concept from the book. From the discussion, we can know each other's viewpoint about money, about history, and link ourselves with the book. So I really enjoy this conversation. The book is really thick, and there are actually many concepts and details can talk about because the time is limit. So we have to end here. Really thank that Advaith joined us and share ideas and concept about this book.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for having me.
Thank you,
Advaith. Thank you, Advaith.
Thank you.
Hope our audience enjoy this episode.